2 Samuel chapter 6, we're not going to go back and read it, but it's a fascinating story. It's one of those passages in the Bible that I've often looked at and wondered, what in the world is that for? I don't know if you've ever read that passage before, maybe it's your first time reading it, you've not been familiar with that passage, or maybe you've read it your whole life and you thought, what in the world is going on with this thing? So we're going to talk about it a little bit and try to dissect some of it. But really, to understand the story that Ramey read for us this morning, we really need to go back a ways to understand what has happened in the decades before this event in David's life, where he brings the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem. Way back in 1 Samuel chapter 6, this is before Saul becomes king, this is before David becomes king, Samuel still judging Israel, the Philistines take the ark. And you might remember the story, it's a fascinating story in itself. The ark becomes a part of the Philistines' possession. They take it, they set it up in their temple, and it causes all sorts of problems for them. Do you remember this? It's a really cool read if you get the chance to read it. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 6. It causes all sorts of problems for the Philistines. It breaks their idols. It disrupts their community. It gives them diseases. All sorts of stuff. Terrible stuff. They captured it thinking that they had gotten a valuable piece of Israelite property. And they ended up actually giving it back. They send it back. Say, take it back. We don't want it. It was so powerful, the power of God, the presence of God there in the Philistine camp, that it was destructive to them. And they said, we don't want it, so they send it back. So when they send it back, 1 Samuel 7, it actually doesn't go right back to the tabernacle. For some odd reason, it ends up in this guy's house named Abinadab, in the town of Kiriath-Jearim, which is a little tiny town about 10 miles outside of Jerusalem. And that's where it stays for over 20 years. Odd place to have a tabernacle or an Ark of the Covenant that should be in the tabernacle in your house, but it literally becomes a part of this guy's house. And the text tells us that Abinadab actually became a sort of priest, and he set up his family as priests to take care of the Ark of the Covenant and to be of service to the Ark, but it's not where it should be in the tabernacle. And so Saul becomes king. David is crowned king. This ark is still in somebody's house in a little town outside of Jerusalem until David decides to bring up the ark out of the house of Abinadab. And his intention at first is most likely to bring it to the tabernacle where it should have been. But if you remember this story, it's in the transportation of the ark that there is a death of a man by the name of Uzzah, who is actually the son of Abinadab, who is one of the priests who's been taking care of the ark. And in the transportation of that ark, the ark is about to fall off of the cart. God had told them, don't touch the ark. And Uzzah reaches out to catch the ark. And you remember the stories, those of you familiar with it. As soon as he touches it, he dies. And David's scared to death. He decides to reroute the ark. He says, I don't want to touch this thing. If this is what it's like to have the ark around me, I don't want anything to do with it. And he puts it away into another man's house by the name of Obed-Edom. Scared of what the ark would become if he brought it to Jerusalem. And it stays in this man, Obed-Edom's house, for 3 months. And during that time, Obed-Edom's house prospers. His livestock are doing well. His wealth increases, and David decides, hey, this might be a good idea to bring this ark to my house, to the temple, or to the tabernacle in Jerusalem. And so, knowing that the anger of the Lord had been assuaged, abated, he brought the ark out of the town of Obed-Edom's place and travels to Jerusalem to take care of bringing it back, finally, after decades, bringing it back to the tabernacle. And this is where we find our story in 2 Samuel chapter 6. It is finally, after decades of being separated from its place where it should be, the ark is being brought back to Jerusalem, and the people and David are ecstatic. And in verse 14 of our passage that we read this morning, says that David danced before the Lord with all his might. And all the house, verse 15 of Israel, brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. This becomes a celebration for all of the people to engage in the fact that this ark is finally coming back to its rightful place of rest in the tabernacle where the Lord is. All of Israel is rejoicing. All of Israel, the king, everyone is rejoicing except for one person. Michal, the wife of David, who is also the daughter of Saul. It says in verse 16 that was read that as the ark was coming into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and sees King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And it says, she despised him in her heart. Why did she despise him? What was David doing that was so despicable to her, that was so repulsive that she would look out her window and think this about the celebration that's going on outside? And so David sets the ark in the tent. He blesses it. He offers burnt offerings, peace offerings, and celebrates with the people. The ark finally coming home, blesses the people. And then the text tells us that he leaves that celebration to go home, to be with his wife, and to bless his own house after blessing the people. Verse 20. And then Michal meets him outside as he's coming in to be with his family and chastises him. And we're not sure, the text doesn't say, but it seems as though she's outside in the public area to meet him, in front of people perhaps even, and chastises him for what he has just done. And you have to read this with a certain sense of sarcasm to it, because I believe that's what she's really saying when she says, how the king of Israel has honored himself today. Verse 21, or 20, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. And David has a kind of snarky response, if you read it right, to her. In response, he says, it was before the Lord who, by the way, chose me above your father and all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, he says. He continues on, and I will be abased or humiliated in your eyes, but by the female servants of whom you've spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. And then the text ends so abruptly, so oddly, after David's statement to Michal, and it says that Michal had no child until the day of her death. Is that not a weird passage? I mean, come on. There's this conversation between husband and wife, king and queen. She doesn't like something that he's done. He responds back kind of snippy as well. Gives her what for. And then, boom, we're done. And the only thing that's said is that this woman, this queen, had no children until the day of her death. So there's a lot of questions. I don't know about you. I have a lot of questions about this. I have a lot of questions. What in the world is this passage doing? Why is it here? What's going on? So here are a few questions that I'd like to answer with you as we go through the rest of this time together, and hopefully maybe give some clarity to why is this story in our Bible? And what is its purpose for us? Why do we need to think about this story? Because it's probably not one of the Bible stories that you taught your children. It's probably not even one of the Bible stories that you're really familiar with, maybe. Except in one of those controversial passages that people like to throw out there and debate about, right? So here's a couple of questions that I have. First of all, what was David doing dancing? Was he naked? The NIV translates it a little bit more risque. It says uncovered himself. Was he naked? And the second question, why did Michal despise him? What was going on that caused her to despise David, what he was doing, all of this? And thirdly, why did Michal not have any children? Was this a coincidence that just kind of was thrown out there to define, you know, the situation a little bit better, to describe her life in general? Or was this a little bit of a punishment for what had happened, the conversation that had taken place between her and David? And really, what we really want to know, who was wrong? Who was wrong in this conversation? Was it David for dancing the way he did doing what he did? Or was it Michael for saying what she said and acting the way she acted? By the way, I find it very interesting that, keep this in mind as we're going through this, Michael is not partaking in the celebration of the ark. It says all of Israel is celebrating this. But then we have Michael, who's apparently off to herself in the palace looking from a distance. So the first question, what was David doing dancing? Was he naked? David was probably not naked, okay? Just so that we're clear on this. It says, in fact, that he was clothed with what they call a linen ephod, which was a priestly garment. So David apparently has taken kind of the role, instead of being king, taken the role of a priest in this situation and led the people in celebration as a priest would as the ark is brought back to Jerusalem. It's possible, I guess, if you want to read into it a little bit, especially as Michael discusses with David about what has just happened, and she makes some comments that perhaps as he's dancing, he has, you know, his dress came up. I don't know what you would say. Like, maybe he slightly revealed himself. The wind blew a certain direction and blew up his linen ephod. I don't know. Apparently, in some way, in Michael's eyes at least, it was inappropriate. But David was not dancing naked. If anybody's ever told you that, if you've ever heard about that from this passage, it's just not true. David is overjoyed at what has happened. Again, the ark is finally in Jerusalem. After so many years of being apart, it's finally back where it should be. And additionally, if we would go back one chapter from this, before our story, David has also just recently conquered the city of Jerusalem. He's taken it from the Jebusites, and he's made it the capital, and so he's elated. And then the next chapter will be that chapter where David will ask now to build the temple to God, now that he has his own palace established. He says, how can the God of the universe dwell in a tent when I have a palace made with human hands? And so David is just excited. And also, this will be a little bit different for us, but dancing is not an uncommon occurrence in the Bible, believe it or not. It's kind of absent from our culture and worship, absent from the New Testament in a lot of ways, but in the Old Testament, if you go back, it's a very common occurrence. And I think probably what we struggle with this passage, one of the things that we struggle with this passage, is that our mind, when we think of dancing, we think of all the bad dancing, right? We think of the bumping and grinding, we think of the Saturday Night Fever stuff, the weird thing, you know, the disco platform shoes. I don't know what you're thinking of when you think of dancing. It's okay, you can laugh. Some of you are laughing. We think about weird, awkward, inappropriate, something of that kind, right? At worst, you probably think, maybe even some of you grew up hearing that dancing is wrong, period. I would venture to guess that that was probably the case for a lot of us. Dancing's just wrong. Any dancing, wrong. At best, you think it's probably not something that we should do in church. You know? So for us, we get this idea of dancing that's completely different from biblical references to dancing. So when the Bible talks about, especially in the Old Testament, the type of dancing that's being referred to here is like leaping and whirling. I don't know if you've ever seen any Middle Eastern cultures dance or movies that depict Old Testament celebrations or something like that where they're leaping and whirling with tambourines. That would be the type of dancing we're talking about here. It's a celebratory type of dance. Has absolutely nothing to do with romance at all. Has nothing to do with anything inappropriate at all. It's celebration. If you go back, in fact, to Exodus 15, just after the Israelites are saved from Pharaoh and his army at the Red Sea, you remember that story? God delivered the people out of Pharaoh's hand, let them walk through the Red Sea on dry land, and then brings the sea back around Pharaoh and destroys him and his armies, saving the people from destruction. After that event, Miriam, sister to Moses, breaks out her tambourine and begins to dance and leads the people in a song. There's a lot of dancing references in Psalms. 149:3 is one of them. It says, "Let them praise His name with dancing, making melody to Him with tambourine and lyre." And then in Jeremiah 31, there's this picture of the people after they come back from exile. They're brought back from Babylon after 70 years away from their land. They're rebuilding their cities, and it says that the people will go out and dance for joy. So it's not what we think of, the vulgar sexual type of dancing, the kind of inappropriate stuff that sometimes we see in our minds when we think of dancing. David is excited. But why did Michael despise him? What was he doing that was so despicable? If dancing was so common for people in those days to celebrate in that way, what was so despicable about David and his dancing that Michael responds in this way? And this is one that admittedly, I just don't know. It's kind of a mystery to me. I mean, was she jealous that maybe it was her husband, not her father, that was able to bring the ark back to Jerusalem now? And the success that David was seeing in his kingdom and her father never saw? I don't know. I just don't know. Maybe, probably more likely, was she under the impression that David's actions were unbecoming of a king? That this just isn't what you do as a king in front of people? And even in today, in Eastern, Middle Eastern countries, there's a very high regard for honor in front of people and respect, and a very high level of sensitivity to being shamed in front of people. And so there are certain things that are appropriate and not appropriate to do in public and in front of other people. And so maybe for Michael, this is just not something that a king does in front of his subjects, to debase himself in such a way. And why did Michael not have any children? Is this a coincidence? Or is it a punishment? Well, I have to say that virtually everybody who I've read about this passage and seen write about this passage pretty much agrees that it's probably not a coincidence. The way that the text ends, the way that things just kind of come to a halt, and the place of this passage at the end of the story is probably not a coincidence. But who was really wrong? If you go on and read the rest of the story of King David, it's interesting because David gets even more powerful. He becomes more influential as a king. But Michael, on the other hand, never shows up again in another passage of Scripture. Which is odd because other wives of David do. Michael is not the only person that's been mentioned, this story about Michael is not the only time that we've heard about Michael. She's been seen before in other stories about David. She saved his life before. She's gotten shuffled around when David and Saul were having their disagreements and David was running for his life. Michael actually gets married off to somebody else. David brings her back. So there's a strong bond, having experienced all this together. But then we find that the story about Michael ends here. We don't read about her anymore. And her story ends with her not bearing children, which for Middle Eastern cultures especially was an awful thing. For a woman, you can have anything happen to you, but God, please, don't make me barren. Remember the story of Hannah? Hannah's not able to have children. And she sits begging God day after day after day at the tabernacle, begging and praying for her to be able to have children. So much so that Eli the priest comes in and thinks she's drunk. She's just absolutely worried that she wouldn't be able to produce any children. Finally, God gives her a child, Samuel. And we know the story of Samuel becomes the judge of Israel. So the text very strongly suggests, I think, that Michael was in the wrong. So what do we do with this? So So Michael was at fault. It seems like that's what the story is trying to relay. In some way, shape, or form, she had done something wrong, and she's unable to have children. So what does this mean for us? That we're supposed to start a dance segment in our worship service or something like that? Twirling classes, leaping classes for worship. It's okay, you can laugh. It's all right. Come on, guys, loosen up. I'm not going to do anything crazy up here. My flags are all at home. I didn't put it. Because I think there is a lesson for us here. And I think the lesson is how we answer this question. The lesson of David's conversation with Michael is, who is your worship really for, and who gets to critique it? Who is your worship really for, and who gets to critique it? David and Michael are standing on two separate lines of view, and they're looking at the same thing. They're both looking at the same celebration. They're both looking at the same event that's taking place in Israelite history, the ark coming back to the temple, or to the tabernacle. One says, this isn't honorable in how you're behaving before the people. Contain yourself. Be respectful. And the other says, I'm absolutely overjoyed that God has blessed us in this way, and I want to worship Him for His goodness. So again, let me be clear in case you think I'm going off some deep end here with this passage. I'm not advocating that we do anything crazy, all right, immoral or unholy about our worship services. Not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that we need to pay attention to this passage because it probably holds more for us than we may realize. Because here's the deal, and we prayed for it already. It's amazing. This happens almost every week. Either at the beginning or the end, we pray, maybe even in there, as I pray with our guys before we come out and lead worship, we pray that our worship would be acceptable to God. Right? That's a common prayer that we pray, and a good prayer that we pray. But what if our prayer that our worship would be acceptable to God is not so much a prayer that it would be acceptable to God as much as it would be a fear of what the person next to me might think about my worship? The person across the room might think. What the person in the church across the road or down the street, across the county, might think about my worship. Not a concern over what is acceptable. Here's the truth. I think that most of us, if we're honest, are afraid to truly worship. And by truly worship, I'm not saying getting up and doing sorts of crazy stuff. I'm saying let your worship be shown outwardly in what you're doing and saying. I led worship in Marysville for several years before we left there. And I can tell you something about, and it's been the same every church that I've ever led worship at. Here's how we worship. So detached, right? I mean, if God set Himself right in front of us, we would never have a clue because we're not paying attention to anything. We are so detached mentally. We are so detached emotionally from what's going on. The fact that we are literally in the presence of the Creator of the universe. That we are worshiping somebody that if He snapped His fingers, you'd die right now. If He blew the wrong way, you'd fall over. And we sit here. And I'm talking about me. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about me. And we're really afraid to truly give our hearts to God in worship. When I was a teen in youth group growing up, we did something that became somewhat of a regular thing for us. And I thought it was really neat. And this is why I say that most of us are afraid to really worship, because of my experience with this. Somewhere, somebody with our youth group, and we didn't have a... Well, it wasn't our youth minister, it was somebody, one of the adult leaders, started to, after class, anybody that wanted to stay could stay and worship together. And our youth group met on Sunday nights in the basement of the church building. It's a standard Church of Christ thing, you know. Auditorium, fellowship hall, and then it became classrooms, and then we had our teen room down there. And so we were in the middle of a basement where there were no doors, no windows. And what we would do is we would close the doors, turn the lights off, and sing. And it was really cool because it totally changed the way that we saw worship and what we did with worship. And you could tell instantly when those lights went off and those doors went closed, you couldn't see a single soul in the room with you. You could tell that things had just changed. The volume got a little louder. The singing got a little bit more authentic and passionate and intense. Because we had stopped worrying about what the person next to us was thinking. And you know how teens are, right? They're already worried about what everybody's thinking about them anyway. They're paranoid. It's like, oh, they don't like me. You know, they looked at me weird. So take all that out of the equation. And every now and then, somebody, you know, one of the adults, and we would stay down there for a long time, one of the adults would be like, you know, where in the world are you? And come in and flip the lights on. And you could see, at that point, what everybody was doing. And we had people that were kneeling. We had people that were laying down. We had people that were sitting. They were raising anything to try to connect with God in worship because they had no fear about what the person next to them was doing or saying about them or thinking. So I've often wondered, why is that? Why are we so embarrassed to worship? And this is what Michael was struggling with. In a sense, she's telling David, you have embarrassed me. You've embarrassed me, you've embarrassed yourself. You should be ashamed of yourself. And David says, no, I won't be ashamed of myself. Because my worship is not for you. It's for God. And in fact, if you think this is bad, I will become more humiliated in your eyes as I worship my God. So what is worship truly? What is true worship? I believe that true worship is this. It's honoring God as we humble ourselves. We lift God up as we humble ourselves. It's not about us. We put God on a pedestal and we take ourselves off of any pedestals that we have for ourselves. And here's what the deal is. I think if we truly humble ourselves, we are going to look different than everyone else. At some level, we are going to look different. Think about it this way. What we're doing already is weird. It is. Somebody that's not a Christian, doesn't know anything about church, what you do, walks into a room full with a bunch of people. Somebody up front waves his arms like this with a bunch of words on a screen, and they're all singing. Who are they singing to? Are they singing to him? Are they listening to themselves? Are they practicing for choir this week in school? Or what's going on? This looks weird to people who are not familiar with worship. So we already are humbling ourselves in what we're doing before our God as we honor Him and humble ourselves. And so why are we really that afraid of expressing ourselves and where we are with God in our worship when we already are weird? I'll tell this story and then I'll be done because I've gone way too long. This week I stumbled onto a video and I shared it on Facebook. Some of you might have seen this video. It was a video that actually happened, I think, last week in a Chick-fil-A in Nashville. And the video shows this group of guys that are getting ready to eat their food. And they start singing in the middle of Chick-fil-A. And what it was there was a worship leader conference going on in Nashville. All these guys, it's not the first time they've done this apparently. They all went to Chick-fil-A afterwards. They've done this over the last several years. They go to the same Chick-fil-A and they begin singing in the middle of Chick-fil-A. One of the songs that they've been doing for their worship leading class. And so this is what happened. One of the guys, a group of guys started singing. Another group over here started singing. Another group over here. And finally, before you know it, half of Chick-fil-A is singing. And the other half is like, what just happened? And it went viral. This particular instance went viral. I don't know how many million views now, but CBS picked it up, did a story on it. These guys are from, you know, Churches of Christ all over the place. And I saw that video this week, and my first response was this. I'll tell you my first response. That's inappropriate. Because I was thinking, I was looking through the video. I watched it a couple times. I was looking for the responses of everyone else in that crowd who didn't know what in the world is going on. Because I was thinking, here there are these bunch of people, and they just want to eat a lunch with their family, with their coworkers. They just want to be able to talk, have a conversation, a break for an hour, and then go back to work, right? And here are these guys that are being obnoxious singing in a Chick-fil-A. But then I got to thinking, I watched that video independent of this. It's funny how this all works together because it wasn't planned. It wasn't part of my sermon. I was working on the sermon and listening to this video. And as I worked on the sermon a little bit, I started to think, you know what? What if that was incredibly accurate as to what our worship should be? Should we care? And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that you go to McDonald's after we're done and start singing in the middle of the drive checkout line. But here, because my initial response was like probably a lot of us, that's embarrassing, right? That's weird. People look at us strange when we do stuff like that. But then I began to think, isn't that what worship is? Weird, strange, doesn't make sense. And at the very core, it's honoring God while humbling ourselves. And so this morning, I want to ask you a question, and then we'll close. I'll be done. And I'll let you kind of think on this passage, because this one will probably create a lot of conversations going home. And I hope that I've communicated clearly, and you don't get any crazy ideas about what I'm suggesting. But here's the question. Who is your worship for? And whose right is it to critique? Who is your worship for? And whose right is it to critique? We're going to sing a song here in a moment. We're going to continue our worship. And as we continue, stop thinking about the person next to you. Just stop. They don't matter. Your God matters. Your heart matters. Not how you sound, not what pitch you're on, not what you do. Your heart and your passion and your interest in worshiping the God of the universe matters. Let's stand as we sing this next song.